Okay. We're going to go ahead in the topic that we're discussing. Even though the yeshiva's not here, I understand that they're going to be hooked in. Okay, I think what we ended with the last time is a tremendous conflict between two truths. One is that everything that HaKadosh Baruch Hu does is for the good. That's a fact. And we also establish that every single thing that happens in the world happens because the Ribbono Shel Olam wants it to happen. So that means there's nothing that happens that is not what the Ribbono Shel Olam does. And we explain that even though people have free choice, but the choice ends with the choice, and the actual what a person does is either sanctioned by the Ribbono Shel Olam or not, and only what the Ribbono Shel Olam wants happens, and everything, therefore, happens for the good. If these two things are true, then you put them together, it means that every single thing that happens, even things that are not directly min hashamayim, but they are things that indirectly happen through people's free choice, but if they happen, it's because the Ribbono Shel Olam wanted them to happen, and ultimately they're for the good. That means that if a suicide bomber blows himself up on a bus and kills tens of innocent men, women, and children, it's for the good. That means that not only, I mean, it's not maybe more problematic than tsunamis and earthquakes and hurricanes that also kill thousands and thousands of seemingly innocent people. So, and that clearly is not the free will of a person. That's clearly min hashamayim. And they are clearly kol mado avid rachmanu l'tav avid. So I don't know if the fact that what human beings do is really ratzon Hashem in the end makes the question even stronger or not, but it just adds to the question. Right, we could get away by blaming the Ribbono Shel Olam for natural disasters and blaming people for people-oriented disasters and at least vindicate the Ribbono Shel Olam for part of it, but it doesn't really help because there's still plenty of things in this world that look terribly tragic that we're supposed to believe are for the good. How do you understand that? In addition, there are people who use this as an explanation to vindicate the Ribbono Shel Olam, and on both counts. And they say, basically, that you can't blame God for the Holocaust, as an example, but it applies to a million other things. You can't blame God for the Holocaust. God gave people free choice, and you have to blame the Nazis for the Holocaust. So it's not God's doing, it's the Nazis' doing. And maybe the same thing goes, there are those that say, with natural disasters. The Ribbono Shel Olam created a world. He created a natural order. He let the world function according to that natural order, and that includes imperfections, like tsunamis and earthquakes, and if people suffer, it's not God's fault. That's the nature of the creation. And with that, they want to vindicate the Ribbono Shel Olam. The truth is that it makes things even worse. It doesn't do the Ribbono Shel Olam any favors. First of all, aside from being apikursis, pashtus, you will not see that's not necessarily the case, because there is an opinion that seemingly what people do is their doing, and the Ribbono Shel Olam taka lets them do what they want to do, even if it's not just. We'll get to that opinion after we finish everything about what we're going to discuss in this opinion, which is the majority opinion and the more operable, accepted opinion. We'll get to the other one and explain it a little bit differently than people normally understand it. But for the time being, we'll just leave it. But it also doesn't mean that the world's hefker, and that the Ribbono Shel Olam just lets anything happen, and it's not his business, and he doesn't interfere with people's free choice, or with the, what's the word I'm looking for, the imperfections in nature. The Rambam says that someone who thinks that Tzaris, Yisurim happened, the Mikra, just happened because of chance, They're just blind mistakes, happenings. And they don't come because the Ribbono Shel Olam wants them to come. And they're there for a purpose, which we'll get to what that purpose could possibly be and how it could be good. Then that is derech achzorios, the Rambam says. It's a way of cruelty. Now, the simple way of understanding the Rambam, I think, is it's cruelty because the Rambam says if you don't learn the lesson from suffering, and therefore you don't better your ways, then the suffering is going to continue. So you're just causing yourself more suffering, which is cruel. But I have a different meaning what the Rambam means. Derech achzorios. Apikorsis, to think that the things just happen and that the Ribbono Shel Olam is not in control of the world. Why is it called cruelty? Because if you believe in a God that permits injustice to happen and people to suffer for no purpose, we're saying now there's no purpose to it. It's just because God gave the world over to free choice, so he doesn't get involved. And he lets people use their free choice to harm other people for no reason, with no benefit. He lets nature take its course because it's imperfect and have thousands and millions of people harmed for no purpose. Then God is cruel. That's cruelty. There's no purpose to it. God just, that's the way he created the world, so he's a cruel God. And we have a mitzvah to emulate God. So if I believe that God is cruel, I have a mitzvah to emulate him and also be cruel. That's derech achzorios. That's a way of cruelty. Because if you can believe that God could just let the Nazis do whatever they want, and 6 million Jews perished and were tortured for no purpose at all, just because that's the way God created the world, then I don't know how that makes God come out looking better than the other possibility, which is God is involved in everything, and he permits nothing to happen that is not his will. But everything that he permits to happen is for the good. How I understand that, I can't understand that. We'll see ways of trying to understand as much as possible. But I don't understand it, but I believe that God permitted these things to be happen, and he directed them because he had a reason why they're good. I would rather believe that. That vindicates God a lot more. It just makes me ignorant than to say that there's no real reason and God's out of the picture and God permits things to happen for no purpose, not for the good, then that makes God, in my estimation, look a lot worse. So in their quest to, like, take God out of the picture and not blame him, they're making God look even worse. So I don't know why that benefit. There's a book, Why Do Bad Things Happen to Good People, by a Kushner, who calls himself rabbi.
It was my Maradoss.
Yeah. It was a reform rabbi who had a difficult life himself. Huh? Conservative rabbi? So he had a child that died of an illness, and so he had to come face to face with this kind of tragedy. His conclusion was that conclusion. God created an imperfect world, and he left things to the forces of nature, and that's it. Just God's, that's not God's job. He doesn't do windows. He doesn't do this either. And he, it's not his domain, by his choice. And somehow that was to make God look better. I don't know. But to me, in my eyes, it makes God look much worse. I wouldn't want to serve a God who's cruel, who just lets things happen for no purpose at all. I'd rather believe in a God who does everything, is involved in everything. And to me, it looks cruel, but ultimately, I believe that God knows better than me, and he knows that what appears to me to be bad is really good. That, I would rather believe that, and God comes out a lot better than the other way. So, even though there is something to talk about the other way, but we'll leave that till we finish with this idea, which is the main hashkafa, and the main hashkafa that's been accepted by Gedolei Yisrael, of recent time and of before this, the way of the Chovos HaLevavos, and even the other way is not as simple and black and white as people would like to believe that the other way is, or whatever people do as they're doing, and somehow God lets it happen. Even though there are ways of explaining that somewhat, there's better ways of explaining what really that means, which is completely different than what these... Rabbi Lamb also has a thing on the Holocaust where he says basically the same thing, that Holocaust happened in a time of Hester Ponim, when there's no rhyme and reason to the world. God just leaves things to nature, and people have free choice, and they blame the Nazis, not God. That is not Emes. There's no such thing. That's not what Hester Ponim is. Okay, but again, we'll discount that for now. We will deal with it a few weeks from now when we finish explaining what the real Hashgatha or the majority Hashgatha is. Then we'll go to the other alternative and try to explain that as best as possible. So we're left with a tremendous seemingly contradiction. On the one hand, God is involved in everything. On the other hand, everything that God does is for the good. And on the third hand, we see a lot of things that don't seem to be good. So how do you resolve those three facts? So I always like to start with a word from Shraga Feivel Mendelovich. Shraga Feivel Mendelovich was the Menahel of Torah Vadas in the 1930s. And he also founded Torah Mesorah. And he said the following word. The Gemara says on the Pasuk, Ein Sur Kelokeinu, Chana said it in her tefillah, after she had a child, there is no rock like HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So the Gemara says, Al Tikrit Sur Eletzayur, there's no artist like HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And the Gemara uses it to explain an idea that even the best artist can only make a facsimile of a thing, can't make a living thing. But the Rabbeinu Shlomo makes the tzura, and he makes the life, and he gives it life, and it's there's no artist like the Rabbeinu Shlomo. He says there could be another meaning to this. Once you're comparing the Rabbeinu Shlomo to an artist, you can have other meanings of how the Rabbeinu Shlomo is an artist. And he gives the following marshal. He says, if you take a kindergarten child, and you tell them to paint the picture of a person standing in front of them. So what do? They draw a circle, that's the head. They draw a line down, that's the body. Two lines out are the arms. Two lines down are the legs. Two dots for eyes, a dot for a nose, big smile, finished. You know exactly what the child is doing every step along the way. You know what's the head, you know what's the body, the arms, and so on. If you tell Rembrandt to paint the exact same picture, paint the picture of the person standing in front of you, so he doesn't start with a circle on the canvas for the head. He dabs a little red paint here and a little black paint over there. Somebody who knows nothing about art will tell Rembrandt, I think you ruined this canvas. Red paint, black paint, you know, I'll get you another canvas, start with the circle and let's get finished. What will Rembrandt tell the person? This painting's going to take me 6 months. Why don't you have patience? Sit down and keep your mouth shut. In 6 months, when you see the whole picture, if you have any questions, let me know. What will be after the end of 6 months? The person will see that the red paint was for contrast and the black paint was for a shadow, and everything fit into the total picture. But until you see the total picture, if you can only see the fragments as you're getting towards the completion of the picture, you can see things in a very distorted way and imagine that what in the end will be a beautiful part of the picture is negative and destructive. So too, says Shraga Feivel Mendelovich, the Rabbeinu Shlomo is the ultimate artist. He is painting a panorama of history that only he knows what components have to go into it. We're sitting in the middle of it, and we see a lot of red blotches and black blotches that to us seem not only not part of the picture, but destructive to the picture. But if we'll wait and see the whole picture, we'll understand that the every part was necessary. And whatever the Rabbeinu Shlomo let happen, even things that were initiated by people's bad free choice, but if God permitted it to happen, there was a reason why it had to happen, and it fits into the whole picture. It's only when we'll see the whole picture that we'll be able to really understand that what's it called, that it was all for the good. But it's because we don't see the whole picture that we don't see that it's for the good. The Chofetz Chaim says a very cute vort of how if you don't see the whole picture, you can distort your hashgatha, and things become problematic hashgathically. He says that there's a pasuk that we say every day, Shomer Hashem Eskolo Abov, Yeskol HaRishoyim Yashmid. Now, there is no problem hashkafically with that pasuk. The Rabbanu Shalom protects all those that he loves, and he destroys all the Rishoyim. No problem at all with that pasuk. It's fair, and it's a nice pasuk. What happens if you never heard the pasuk in your life? Never heard that pasuk. And you one day walk into shul, and you hear people saying the following, right, with great kavana, but you walked in late. So you got there in the middle of the pasuk. And you heard the following, Eskol Ohavav, V'Eskol HaRishoyim Yashmid. All those that he loves, and all the Rishoyim God's going to destroy. Now that is a big problem. Right? How could we have a Torah and say with great kavanah that God's going to destroy all the people he loves? And the Rishoyim? Doesn't seem to be fair. Or what happens if you never heard the pasuk, and you're sitting in shul, and you leave early, and you only hear the first part of the pasuk? Shomer Hashem Eskol Ohavav, V'Eskol HaRishoyim. God protects all those that he loves and all the Rishoyim. And then you walk out. You also have a big problem. Why should God want to protect all the Rishoyim, including the ones that he loves, but why the Rishoyim too? So if you come late to shul, or you leave early, you get a totally distorted view of something that if you would hear the whole pasuk would be a problem. Says the Chofetz Chaim, we come late to this world and we leave early. So we see a totally distorted picture of people who we think deserve good who are getting bad, and people who we think deserve bad who are getting good. But the truth is, if we'd see the whole picture, we'd see that the good that appears to be good for the evildoers is not good at all, and the bad that seems to be bad for the tzaddikim is really not bad at all. That in the total picture, the good is good for the tzaddikim, and the bad is bad for the rishonim. The Knaf Rananim, Perish on Perek Shira. Perek Shira has become a fad. But there was a Perish on it. It's not just a bunch of psukim where the animals say or whatever. That each thing has a very deep idea behind it. Why those animals represent those psukim? What can you learn from those animals or whatever? So in his Hakdama to the Perek Shira, the Knaf Rananim, which is, by the way, quoted by Rabbi Chanan Wasserman. But I have a sefer. There is such a sefer, and it's a nice long perush. I mean, the perush here, it's a thick sefer. So, in there, in Sakdama, he says the following marshal. Same idea. He says, take a person who never was out on a farm. And he's a city slicker. And the first time in his life, he goes out to a farm. He sees a farmer carrying what appears to him to be cereal in his hands. And he figures, oh, the farmer is a little crude. Right? We usually put cereal in boxes. Right? He's carrying the cereal in his hand. He's probably going to eat breakfast. He sees, instead of going to eat breakfast, the farmer goes to a muddy area of his field and throws the cereal into the mud and starts stamping on it and burying it in the mud. So he goes over to me and says, I hate to say anything, but you see, we people in the city appreciate the cereal that you just threw in the mud. We eat it for breakfast. It's extremely tasty. Right? Why would you want to waste that cereal and throw it in the mud? So the farmer says, I see they've never been on a farm. He said, you know what? Why don't you come back in 6 months and meet me at this spot? And if you have any questions, then I'll answer them. 6 months later, he comes back, and exactly that spot, there is growing hundreds of times of the wheat or this grain that the farmer put into the ground. So the guy says, hey, this guy's not such an idiot. Right? Obviously, there's a thing of planting seeds, grain, and then you get more grain. So he says, okay, the farmer, I see something to this. He says, now he's probably going to have a real good breakfast. So he sees the farmer cut down the grain, and he figures he's going to take it now and go eat it. And instead, he takes the grain, and he starts beating it, and then he starts throwing it up in the air, or whatever, and winnowing it, and he figures the farmer's really gone crazy. I mean, what did this grain do to him? Eat it for breakfast. Don't eat it. What do you have to take out your anger and frustration on this poor grain? He beats it to a pulp, mamish. And he figures, okay, maybe the guy doesn't like to eat. Maybe he doesn't have too many teeth or whatever. He can't eat the grain whole. So he's going to eat the powder. Nope. Takes the powder, mixes it with water. Now he has some kind of gummy, what's it called, doughy stuff. Says that doesn't look as good as the grain, but maybe these farmers don't know what's good to eat. So he figures now he's going to eat this doughy mixture. Now puts it into a fire. Now he's burning it. The guy's out of his mind. Right? He's a sadist. And then he sees the bread. Once he sees the bread, he understands that all the things that he saw that appeared to be negative, destructive, were really part of a process that led to the desired result. And the bread is a lot better than cereal. So he realized, now the farmer's not an idiot, but he didn't realize what the process was. So too, says the Knaf Ranonim, we only see a portion of the process. We don't know what this final result of that process is going to be. If we could see the final result, we'd understand that the things that appear to us to be very destructive and unfair or whatever are really constructive and very fair. But we don't see the process. We don't see that all of this is part of a process of creating bread. We see it as getting even or destroying or harming the grain, which is not the case. But because we don't see the whole picture, we misread things and think that what we see is totally bad. Okay. Rav Yosef Apshitz says a similar idea on another Gemara. The Gemara says that when Rabbi Akiva was being flayed, his skin was being flayed with iron combs. They were killing him with a slow, torturous death. So the Malachim cried out, Zu Torah v'zu Schar. We don't understand, Rabbi Nishon. This man is a giant in Torah. Tzadik. This is his reward. That he should be tortured to death. The Rabbi Nishon told them, keep quiet. Otherwise, I will turn the world back into tohu vavohu. So on the surface, it appears to be a threat. In other words, don't question me, right? Kach also the machshav alafonai. This is my will. This is what I thought, the Rabbi Nishon says. You are puny, measly angels, and therefore, if you don't keep quiet, I'm going to turn the whole world back to tohu vavohu. Rabbi Yonasan Amishan says a completely different shot. The Rabbi Nishon wasn't threatening the malachim. He was giving them an answer to their question. The question was, Lechora, how could it be that this should be the reward for people who are tzaddikim and only Torah like Rabbi Akiva? It doesn't make sense to us. So Moshe told him like this. He gives a Moshe. He said there was an exquisite tailor, a Jew, who was known throughout this king's kingdom being the finest tailor that ever existed. And the king wanted the finest robe that ever existed. So he went to this Jew, and he told him, I'm going to give you the best materials, silk and gold and fine jewels. I want you to make me the most exquisite robe that ever existed. So he gives him all these expensive materials, and sure enough, the tailor makes the most exquisite robe that ever existed. The king is very happy, and he rewards the tailor richly. There are a lot of anti-Semites who can't stand the fact that this tailor was given the money and the covet or whatever he's getting, and they want to undermine and make sure this tailor gets what he deserves in their eyes as for being a Jew. So they go to the king and they say to him, you know, you're very happy with your robe, but don't you know that the Jew stole, robbed you blind? He didn't put everything that you gave him into that robe. He kept a lot of the gold and the silk and the precious stones for himself. And he put in the rest, and you're happy with the robe, but you were robbed blind by this Jew. So the king goes to the tailor, and he says, I've been told that you didn't put everything into the garment that I gave you. And I would like an accounting for every single thing that I gave you, right, that you used it in the garment. So the tailor says, fine. He says, give me the rope. He gives him the rope. He starts to unravel it. He says, what are you doing? He said, well, there's no way that I could show you that every single thing that you gave me found its place in the rope unless I take the rope apart. I've taken it apart and count every strand and show you that every single piece of everything you gave me is there somewhere. But you can't see it. You just look at the whole rope. You'd have to see it separately. So give me the robe, I'll unravel it, take every single piece apart, put it down on the table, and you'll be able to make a tally and see that everything that you gave me is there. So too, says the Rav Yonasan Apshitz, the following. The Rav Yonasan said, look, I had a plan for the world. I planned this tremendous panorama of history. which will end with tzaddikim getting what they deserve and rishonim getting what they deserve. And every single part of that plan is fair and is 100% what has to be. And this is part of it too. But you can't see it unless I can unravel everything and show you all the points that went in. You don't know what all the points went into the plan, then you can't really appreciate the plan when it's in the middle of being done, or when it's just in front of you in one big mishmash. So if you want to really understand the answer to that question of Zu Torah v'Zu Schara, I'd be happy to take the world and break it back into its components, and then you can see all the components of what my intention was, and you'll see where this fits in to the entire plan. But there's no other way for me to explain to you how this fits into the plan unless you understood the plan from the beginning with all its components. And that's beyond your ability, and therefore there's no tachlis of doing that. The Rebbe wasn't threatening them, he was just telling them that the only way you could understand that is by understanding every prat in the plan that I had, and it, all its components. That's beyond the ability of even an angel. The truth is that this is what HaKadosh Baruch Hu told Moshe Rabbein when he asked the question. Hodieni no ezbrachecho, like we explained. So the Rebbe Lashem told him the following. He told him, V'ra'isa achorai uponai lo yiro. I'll pass over you, and you'll see the back, but you won't see my front. There's many, many pshat in the Ksav Sofer and the Ksam Sofer, both of them, say that it means the following. In the context of what we've talked about, it fits in beautifully. It said like this, Rabban Shem Tov Moshe Rabbeinu, when the world will reach its completion, and you'll see the whole picture, then looking back in retrospect, you'll understand everything. You'll understand that how everything fit in to the final picture. But uponai, looking ahead, when you haven't seen the whole picture, you only see fragments, lo yiro, you can't understand it. You can only understand it when you see the whole picture looking back. But looking ahead, when you can't see the whole picture, there's no way to understand it. In a little bit different way, Rav Shamshon for Hirsch says the answer was in the first part of the pasuk. He named makom iti, there's a place up here with me, v'nitzavto latzur, stand, right, and then, v'ra'isa achorai uponai lo yiro. So, the way Rav Shamshon for Hirsch explains the pasuk is the following. But before I tell you how he says it, I'll tell you a story that illustrates what Rav Shamshon for Hirsch says. The Rav Tzvi Hirsch Meisels, who was the Weizner Rav, was in Auschwitz. And people asked him questions there. He was like the Rav of Auschwitz. In many situations where they brought, he was a posek. He lived out the last years of his life in Chicago. The Weizner. Anybody from Chicago has heard of the Weizner of Rav Meisels, right?
They call it the Weizner Seder.
Okay. So he had a brother who lived in Miami. It was the Ilerov, also Meisels. They were poskim, a regular Hungarian poskim. And he wrote a sefer called Mekadshei Hashem. It's a collection of tshuvas and divrei Torah from people who were killed during the Holocaust. And in his Hakdama, he gave a few incidents that happened to him in Auschwitz. And we will eventually speak about them in very interesting halachic shailas or whatever that came up. And when we get to that part of this inyan, we'll discuss them in detail. But he tells a story, the following story. He says that one day he was summoned to the office of the commandant of the camp in Auschwitz. Usually that meant that you didn't return. The commandant was a sadist, to say the least, and he enjoyed killing people arbitrarily. And whenever he was bored, he would call an inmate into the office and torture him or just capriciously use him for target practice or whatever. So he realized that this is probably it. So he gave his food ration to split it up between some people. The food was a commodity that meant life, and if he wasn't going to need it, so better other people should benefit from it. took off his boots and his coat and he gave it to this one, that one, that why should he be killed and the Germans take his things, let some other Yidden benefit from it. And he said, Vidui, and he went to the office of the commandant, thinking that that was it, this is just now he's going to meet his death. And the commandant told him, Herr Rabiner, sit down, I want to ask you something. So he sat down, and the Nazi says to him, don't you have questions on your God, why he's permitting us to do what we're doing to you Jews? Doesn't it bother you? Right? Don't you have questions that you'd like to ask your God and get some answers? So he said to him, I'll tell you, when I was a little boy in Cheder, our Rebbe told us not to ask too many questions on God, because he'll invite us up to give us answers, and we don't want to be invited up so fast. We'd rather... So he said, since then I had patience not to ask too many questions, because I really wouldn't like to be invited up so fast. I'll keep the questions here, and I'll wait till I get up there, and then I'll ask God the questions. So the commandant started laughing, he liked the answer, and he let him go. Sent him back. Based on that, that's what Rav Shamshon von Hirsch says. So that's the answer that the Rav Shamshon gave to Moshe Rabbeinu. He named Makomiti. You want to come up here and look at the world from my vantage point, from my perspective, there's no questions. The way I see it, there's nothing, no problem at all, Moshe. I don't see Tzadik Haralo, I don't see Rosh HaVatovlo, I see the whole picture. And the whole picture beyond time, there's no problem at all, there's no questions. So if you want to come up here, right, Moshe Rabbeinu, no problem, you're welcome to look at it from my perspective, but you can't go back. But from your perspective, there's no answers. From my vantage point, the Rav Shamshon says there's no questions. And from your vantage point, there's no answers. So until you see it from my vantage point, beyond time, the total picture, there's no way to give answers, except in general, that's the answer, that there is no answer. That ultimately it's for the good, but we don't see it, because we only see a fragment, we don't see the whole picture. And that is the idea, what Chazal say, Kesher Shot Tefillin. What did the Rav Shamshon show him when he showed him the bat? He showed him the knot of the Tefillin Shorosh. What does that mean? That means that you see everything emanates from that oneness of God. It's all strapped to the, what's it called, to the bias of the Tefillin. And there the four different parshios, Shema, V'hoyim Shamoa, Kaddish, V'hoy Kiviyacha, are all one. They're all made into one. There's different attributes of God. There's different ways that we see the Ribono Shel Olam. But ultimately, they're all one. But from that oneness emanates many separate things. Things that look good, things that look bad, and they're black. Part of the one side of the straps have to be black, and the bias has to be black. The things in this world that look very black, look very bleak, look very bad, unfair. But they all, if you trace them back to their source, they all emanate from that one, what's it called, from the Ribono Shel Olam, and they're all really for the good. But since we don't see them as that oneness, we see this Ritzua trailing off to this side, and this Ritzua to that side, so we see what appears to be two different kinds of anagas, good and bad. So that's why it's a problem to us. But if we could trace it back to its source, we'll see the whole thing, we'll see the bias, how it all connects in, then you'll understand that it all comes from the same Ribono Shel Olam, and it's all for the good, ultimately. The Chafetz Chaim gives two mishalim, and it's good that it's late at night, so you don't have to eat another meal till the morning, for one of them. Two mishalim that are pretty, one of them is pretty graphic on Rosh HaVatovlo. Why Rishoyim seem to prosper, and Tzadik Varalo is a pretty innocent marshal. The marshal for Tzadik Varalo, how come we don't see Tzadikim get what they seemingly deserve? So he gives the following marshal. He says somebody comes to a city for a Shabbos, and he sees that on the Mizrachvant, in that shul, there is an array of great Talmidei Chacham, a whole wall full of Rabbah. So he says, I'll never get an Aliyah here tomorrow. If Adi, they're going to give all these Choshuva people Aliyahs tomorrow, I'll never get an Aliyah. And he sees the Gabbai calls up a Kohe, not even from the Mizrach Band, and a Levi, not from there. And Kimat, nobody on the Mizrach Band gets an Aliyah. And he gets an Aliyah. So he goes over to the Gabe after davening, and he says, look, I hate to tell you how to do your job, but if we had this array of great people in our shul, we would give them aliyahs. You skipped over all the people that Lechari should have given the covet of giving an aliyah. So the, by the way, right, it's usur to argue with the Gabbai. Right, you shouldn't, what's it called, it's a good advice that if the Gabbai does something, you don't question it or whatever. Maybe the Tuvei Ha'ir, the people responsible, could bring the Gaboyim and ask them in general what their policies are or whatever. But in any specific situation, the idea is not to cause strife and not to question what a Gabbai does. He doesn't. In any case, if you don't like what the Gabbai does too much, then you get a different Gabbai. The Tzibur has a right to do that. But to argue with a Gabbai on a piecemeal level, that is a good idea not to do. In any case, so this guy said to the Gabbai, I hate to tell you how to do your job, but you don't seem to know what you're doing. So the Gabbai said to him, look, you're here for one Shabbos. You know, we have a whole year with a whole system. And everybody has to get aliyahs throughout the year. So we save the aliyahs for these important people, for Yom Narayim, for Shel Segalim, right, when they have Yahrzeit, whatever it is, there's a reason why these people get it this time and other people get it another time. How can you ask me a question on why this one got an aliyah or this one didn't get an aliyah if you're only here for one Shabbos? Why, don't give everybody aliyahs on one Shabbos. It's a system throughout the year. So too says the Chofetz Chaim. We have tainus. How come this tzaddik didn't get what we think he deserves or whatever? You're only here for one Shabbos. Maybe he'll get it next Shabbos. Maybe in the next world. Maybe he got it when you didn't realize it, whatever. You don't see the whole system. You only see one Shabbos. How could you ever complain that he didn't get what you think he deserves because one Shabbos he didn't get it? Because in your small lifetime you didn't see it? That's the marshal of Tzadik Varala, what appears to be Tzadik Varala. The other marshal is much more graphic, and I'll leave you with that so you can get a good night's sleep. The marshal goes like this, a little bit more involved. He says that we see Rishayim that seem to be living it up. They have cars and planes and big bank accounts and live in villas and they're Rishayim and they're not sick and they're healthy. So he gives the following marshal. He says there was a king whose prime minister rebelled against him and tried to make a coup and to depose him and become king. And he was caught. And the king, instead of executing him, wanted to make a spectacle of him that no one should ever think of trying to rebel against him again. So he wanted to kill him, execute him in the most torturous way that he could think of that would really be a deterrent to other people to know that if you even try to rebel against me and you're caught, this is what's going to happen to you. So he decided that the most torturous way of murdering a person is starving him to death slowly. So he decided that's what he's going to do to this prime minister. So he told everybody in the kingdom has to come and witness this execution on this and this date. The person is going to be brought into a closed glass enclosure and starved to death slowly in front of everybody. Everybody can watch him starve to death minute by minute. So they put the person, before they execute him, they give him his final meal, and he eats, you know, and he's filled up to here, just like we feel, what's it called, the Erev Yom Kippur, you know, after Suda Matzekes, you couldn't stuff another thing into your mouth. And you come to call Nidre, your mamish, like, you know, bloated. And so the guy goes into the glass thing, and everybody's there, and he's like an animal in a glass cage, and everybody's making faces, and he's laughing. He feels great. He's making faces back, and it's a whole joke. 24 hours later, he's not laughing anymore. He's sitting, conserving his strength. He feels like we feel Ne'ilah time. Yom Kippur, 24 hours already passed with a fast. Hasn't eaten, hasn't drunk anything, and he's pretty tired. 2 days pass, 48 hours. The guy can't even sit up. He's lying down. He's very tired, very hungry, and he can't come out, can't move. By the third day, somebody who missed the first 2 days, who got stuck in traffic or whatever, comes to see this execution. He really wants to see what's going on. Because he's interested in seeing how somebody starves to death, right? He's a real sadist. So he's hoping he hasn't missed the good part, and the guy is already dead. So he gets in, comes in on his horse, gets off the horse, starts pushing his way through the crowd, hoping that he'll get to the front and be able to see the action before the guy dies. Meanwhile, as he's pushing his way through the crowd, this guy becomes delirious because of his hunger, can't take it anymore, and in a fit of delirium, he takes a bite out of his arm, his own arm, and he starts chewing on the meat and the blood of the arm that he, what's it called, that he just took a big bite out of himself. At that moment, this guy pushes through the crowd, and he's now face to face with the guy who's supposedly starving to death. And what does he see? He's eating red meat. Right? Hey, I've been cheated. I was told to come to watch an execution, somebody starving to death, and they're feeding the guy red meat. I want my money back. Yeah, says the Chafetz Chaim, yeah, the guy's eating red meat. But if you would have come 2 minutes earlier, you would have seen where that red meat came from. He's eating up his own arm. So he says, same thing. Yeah, they're a Shoyim, they have their bank accounts, and they have their health, and they have their cars, and their yachts, and whatever. Yeah, but you know what it's coming off of? It's coming off their Olam Haba. They're eating up alive their nitzvias. So yeah, they look like they're really rolling in grave. They're eating the red meat, but the red meat, they're eating themselves alive. They're eating their Olam Haba up. That's where it's coming from. So if you'd really see what this Russia is getting, it's not good at all. For him, it's terrible. Maybe good for the world in general that the Russia should suffer like that. But ultimately, right, what he's getting is not Russia Metoglo. It's not Russia who's getting it good. It's Russia who's getting what he really deserves. Except what he really deserves to you looks like eating red meat, when in fact he's eating up his own flesh. He's eating himself alive. So when we see what appears to be Tzadik Viralo, or Russia Metoglo, it's only again because we don't see the whole picture. But if we'd see the whole picture, we'd see that from the ultimate perspective, beyond time, everything really is fair and ultimately for the good. Okay. Next time, we'll continue this idea a little bit more, from more Mamore Chazal, and get it a little bit more clear. And then I'm going to destroy it, because it's absurd. If you think about it, I'm not going to tell you why. Think about it a little while. If what I told you is really true, then it's really absurd. A lot of things are absurd. There's two tremendous questions you can ask on it. And if unless you understand how to answer those questions, everything we've said is really ridiculous. Everything's for the good, except we don't see it, or whatever we'll see doesn't jive with how we function in this world. It doesn't jive with a lot of these soldos of Yiddishkeit. So unless you understand how to answer that, and how to understand what I'm saying, the right, the way that it really is, then just saying this idea that everything's for the good and we don't see it and God sees better, that's not sufficient. It's going to lead to stronger questions than to answers. And again, now it seems very nice, and this is what everybody says, but if you don't end with what I'm going to tell you, or at least next, by the end of next week, give you the questions, right, then what I'm telling you now is can be whisked away in a second by somebody who wants to give a good argument. It's a good argument.